now, preserving another piece of our history. Neighbors in Parkland, south of Tacoma, have been working for 2 years to save the historic Parkland School. There is a significant fundraising deadline coming up at the end of April, and our resident historian Felix Bunnell is here after visiting Parkland to find out what's about to happen.
Yeah, so this grassroots group, they've got about $700,000 in commitments toward a $2.8 million purchase price. They need to raise about $230,000 in cash by the end of the month to make a down payment. More about that in a moment. Parkland is an unincorporated Pierce County along Highway 7 on the way to Mount Rainier. Parkland School was built in 1908 with some later additions. It's probably the oldest building in existence by a matter of decades. It actually has the word Parkland built into its structure. The letters are right there in the concrete over the front door where it says Parkland School. Now, it was a public school until about 40 years ago when PLU, Pacific Lutheran University, purchased it from the school district and made it part of their university campus, which is about a block or so away. PLU and Parkland were essentially founded at the same time in 1890, so they're very closely linked. As we reported nearly 2 years ago, PLU was going to demolish the school and sell the land to evil developers. No, they weren't evil, they're just developers. Word got out and the community coalesced around trying to save the school instead. A grassroots campaign came together with a few dozen people who lived in Parkland but who didn't know each other. In fact, when I met outside the school in that brilliant sunshine yesterday, I told Gunnar Johnson, David Nelson, and Wendy Freeman that if you looked in the dictionary under Grassroots Historic Preservation Group, I think you'd find their photo. This is Wendy Freeman.
We are the root of the grass. We came. We are the sod beneath the roots. We came to. There were 24 people sitting in the church foyer lobby. The first time we got together, we'd never met each other before. We were total strangers, and we were all getting organized and figuring out what to do, and we've got to save the school, and holy cow. And I would say that we're probably the single most diverse group of people I've ever met in my life. I don't think we agree about anything. I mean, we don't even agree about recipes. You know, we don't agree about anything, but we agree about the school.
And what they agree about for Parkland School is that it could be exactly the community center that Parkland needs to house a variety of groups and services and give Parkland the center of gravity that everyone agrees it currently lacks. Now, another member of the group was David Nelson. He attended Parkland School more than 60 years ago, and he recently moved back.
Did you go to this school?
Yes, I did.
Why is the school so special?
I don't know. It just brought the community together. Everybody knew each other back in the day in Parkland. And I think if they make it a community center now, it'll bring it back to what it once was. By everybody now is kind of like strangers. Everybody kind of hides in their house and everything. Well, if you get a community center, get seniors in there, get youth in there, get people from the community in there, you know, you become more friends than just acquaintances or strangers.
Now, the group has accomplished so much in the last couple of years, like securing grants and pledges of support that I mentioned. It's also easy to forget that one of the first things they did was meet with PLU President Alan Belton to negotiate a deal to stop the demolition and purchase the school instead. One of the members at that key meeting was with us yesterday. That's 20-something PLU graduate Gunnar Johnson. He says working with PLU has been notably non-controversial, non-adversarial.
From that first meeting, like, I could tell there was a willingness to cooperate, but maybe just like not as clear a path forward, at least from PLU's standpoint. But I'm really glad that we've come this far, even to the extension of the deadline. I think that speaks a lot to, I don't know, the agreeable nature of, like, you know, what we want and what PLU wants. PLU wants to make sure this building goes to a group that's going to use it, and we want to be that group.
You know, as Gunnar mentioned, PLU has extended this deadline for the down payment of $230,000 to April 30th, so that's less than 4 weeks. Now, in addition to raising money, the Parkland Group has also been busy putting together a business plan, getting commitments from partners and tenants to map out a future that serves Parkland. This isn't just about some, you know, old people trying to save a school that everyone loves. It really is about the future and about Parkland needing something. Now, Wendy Freeman named several groups have already agreed to take space in Parkland School and to donate labor and materials to do necessary repairs.
So these are people that are saying, yeah, we want to be in the building, we want to work. And when we talked to the community was really concerned about health and wellness. They were very interested in recreation. We have the gym. So if we have it open, it can be a recreation area for the kids. They're also very interested in youth and senior programs. They've said that a lot. So we're trying to be respectful of what the community is asking for, but those are our partners, and those are people that are really interested in being tenants. So they would take a part of the building. This is 36,000 usable square feet.
And it's totally solid. The building needs a little bit of repairs, but it could be opened, you know, within a few weeks of work being done to it. Now, Parkland's not a city. It's unincorporated Pierce County. There's no mayor or community council or anything. Janie Hitchin is a Pierce County council member whose district includes Parkland. She's a PLU grad who took classes in Parkland School. She's been a big supporter of the effort and has devoted a lot of time and attention to the project. Pierce County has pledged about $32,000 to the effort through a historic preservation grant. Now, Councilmember Hitchin knows that's a drop in the bucket toward the $2.8 million total purchase price. She says she and her staff have been beating the bushes for other funding sources.
It's one of those things where I applaud the group that is doing this and have stood on the street corner with them, shown up at rallies. I'm going to the, you know, El Toro with them. It's because I've walked that campus. I took classes in that school, worked with kids there, and it really is a beautiful building. It's just it's one of those things where we haven't been able to find, you know, the money available without strings attached or rules attached or timelines attached that work with where we are.
You know, Councilmember Hitchin mentioned going to El Toro. That's a fundraiser being held next Monday, April 8th at El Toro restaurant in Parkland. Everyone's going to be there. A portion of the proceeds will go towards saving the building. That prompted one more question for me of Wendy Freeman.
What do you recommend at El Toro?
The carne asada is to die for. It's my favorite. I love it to death. And their green salsa, yummy. I'm telling you right now. So good. And my husband loves the bacon wrapped shrimp. It's kind of an appetizer, but it's got sauce, cheesy sauce on it. Oh, he loves that so much.
Kind of early in the morning to be talking about now in retrospect, as I hear that. Now I really want this group to succeed. We all talk about, you know, meeting with our neighbors and reconnecting in this divisive times and everything. These guys are actually doing it, and they're so close. If only 460 listeners gave $500, they'd have their $230,000. I don't often plug fundraising campaigns. This one feels different to me. There's so much good at stake here. You can go to saveparklandschool.org and make a contribution. I'm notably stingy, right? I'm even going to make a contribution to this one, Dave. This one's that important to me.
So. All right. Good luck.
Yeah, saveparklandschool.org, everybody.
Our resident historian, Felix Bunnell. Let's talk about tax season. 12 days left. We consult with our tax whisperer, Kenneth Williams from CLA. The Senate has been holding up the latest tax changes, including the child tax credit, which has had some taxpayers holding off on filing. So I asked Ken to explain what's going on there.
They would increase the credit. And, of course, we're still kind of waiting to see if there are amendments. One of the conditions that the Republicans are raising is that they don't want it to be retroactive, where you can use income from previous years to be eligible for the credit. So that's still to be ironed out. But, you know, the current credit of $2,000, that could be doubled. And so it's big dollars for some people. And right now, the legislation, as it's written, would make it retroactive to 2023. And of course, we are 3 weeks away from a filing deadline. So that's a big question in people's minds.
Ken says the credit could double under the new proposed legislation. But for most filers, the increases would probably not end up getting that full amount. They would stand to collect more like $200. Moving beyond the tax credit, I know that another question is how the additional funding for the IRS is being spent, as in, are there going to be more audits, and can the IRS finally answer the phones?
Yeah, we've seen some improved timeliness in correspondence. Of course, it's coming off the heels of COVID, where it was hard to get a response to anything for a while, but we have seen more responsiveness on the phones and in correspondence. We've also seen an increase in activity of the IRS investigating things, particularly with regard to this employee retention credit that is, you're seeing a lot in the news right now. The IRS just touted that they estimate they've already saved $1 billion in fraudulent claims related to the employee retention credit.
Now, these were the payments that went out during the pandemic to keep businesses open, and some people decided to take advantage of that.
Yeah, exactly. This was a credit that was created during COVID, basically trying to reward employers for continuing to employ their employees, even when they had significant declines in revenue. And so you could file this claim and get a refund or a credit from the IRS for having continued to employ your employees. And unfortunately, a lot of people fell victim to people that were out there marketing these things and filing claims that just weren't valid. And so the IRS has really ratcheted up their compliance. They provided a chance to come forward voluntarily that ended last week, where you could basically come forward and say, I think I may have been convinced to file a claim that wasn't valid, and you get a free pass on penalties and interest. That expired last week. They estimate about $250 million were refunded through those voluntary disclosure arrangements. Another $250 million was people that just came forward and said, I'm withdrawing my claim. And then another $500 million of the IRS sending out notices saying, we think your claim's fraudulent, and unless you provide documentation, we're not going to give you the credit.
What was the most common way that people ran afoul of this? Did they take the money and then not retain their employees, or something else?
Well, it was a credit that was based on historical facts. So if you had the revenue declines and you had you can demonstrate that you had the employees, then you were able to file a return, an amended payroll tax return, in which you got the refund. But the rules associated with this, there were some pretty straightforward computations. And then there were some allowances made for special circumstances. And this is where the camel got his nose under the tent flap. And a lot of people started making claims related to interruption of supply chain or government mandated shutdowns. And people were interpreting these rules quite liberally. And the IRS came out and said, no, you're completely misunderstanding how to apply these rules, and we're not going to allow these claims. But that didn't stop people from continuing to file the claims and earning commissions, some of these boiler rooms that were creating these claims for unknowing taxpayers, saying, oh, yeah, it's legit, and then come to find out it's not.
Kenneth Williams from CLA. Cairo News Radio Sam Campbell has joined us for the grand finale of his exclusive video series titled In Plain Sight, looking at the practices of the nonprofit group We Heart Seattle and how they've been addressing homelessness in the city. Sam, bring us up to date on what you on the first two parts, first of all.
Right. Well, Dave, in part one, you know, we examined the fact that We Heart Seattle volunteers were the ones to find human remains in a green space near Dexter and 4th Avenue. And we kind of examined that in terms of look at city land, and yet these volunteers had found these human remains. And then I started talking with Andrea Suarez, the founder of We Heart Seattle, about what her group does and going out to these encampments, picking up what they call trash. And she has a lot of very, colorful opinions about how she believes that the policies in King County and the city of Seattle are failing when it comes to addressing the homelessness crisis. And in part two, we actually heard from critics who accused their nonprofit of things like destroying people's tents without permission. Its founder, Suarez, was accused of misrepresenting herself as a caseworker. Now, Suarez denies all those accusations, rather dismissing them as made up. So in part three, you know, we look at, you know, they are defending themselves from these accusations. But meanwhile, there's a court case involving a man who formerly served as their board president. That's playing out in Oregon. Kevin Dahlgren is his name. He created a social media following that's really centered around documenting the living conditions of homeless people. But now he's facing charges for allegedly stealing the identities of homeless people in Portland. And court documents say he was working as a homeless services specialist for the city of Gresham, Oregon, at the time. So he's also listed in We Heart Seattle's tax documents as having been paid almost $30,000 for consulting fees in 2022. And he was paid about $5,300 the year before that, according to their 2021 documents. So I asked Suarez, to comment on this, the fact that their former board president is now facing these charges. And she tells us that he had limited involvement with her nonprofit.
In short, validating what I was already doing, he has 20 plus years in the field, but there's not any reason to believe that he took or stole or committed any crime while, you know, on the clock, so to speak, with We Heart Seattle here in Seattle. And we're heartbroken for anybody harmed and wish him, you know, the best path out that's fair and justice, fair and equitable for all.
I'm just curious, so what would he have to gain by stealing a homeless person's identity? They haven't got any money, right?
Likely the same thing that anyone might gain from identity theft. You know, I'm not a lawyer or a law enforcement expert, Dave, but I can imagine that there are certain assistance programs who might have been helping those homeless people. Again, that's not listed specifically in the court documents that I've obtained, but that might be what someone has to gain.
Okay, so Andrew's organization recruits volunteers. So there have been a lot of people who work with her. What do volunteers think about her organization?
Right. You know, we've heard from the critics and the accusations, but the group that's closest to Suarez really, really, truly believes in their cause. At least they did when I was out there and I was talking with them. And one of those men is DJ Ziegler. He actually used to be homeless, and now he volunteers with them. In fact, his being homeless is how he says he met Suarez and We Heart Seattle, and now he's helping pick up debris at their visits to these camps.
Well, I know that Andrea accepted me as I am at that time, and she didn't put a bunch of stipulations on me. She didn't have a bunch of expectations. She just gave me that taste of the work ethic that I so much craved.
He says she offered him a, quote, stipend to work with her team moving his things, but could not recall the value of it when asked. He says he later checked himself in with authorities on an outstanding warrant before going to detox for meth addiction. Ziegler says without Suarez and We Heart Seattle, he doesn't know if he'd have done the same thing.
And the nice thing is the picks are only 2 or 3 or 4 hours, so it's just a taste of enough to get you on in track. And then you start, and then that 2 hours turns into 4 hours, turns into 6 hours that I'm able to actually work or function. So in the beginning, it was 2 hours or 3 hours every Saturday, and that was just enough to be able to start a process and get me back on track.
And in addition, this part is new. Since the recording of the video, Suarez actually told me that her nonprofit paid $6,000 for Ziegler, as well as another fellow volunteer, Cody Pickett, to go into recovery-oriented housing after a 30-day inpatient stay. And so we're covering this in part three. And in addition, if you go to our website on My Northwest, you're going to find a little bit of extra context that I didn't have time to include in the video. Some of that includes the latest numbers from the King County Medical Examiner's Office. Now, when I spoke with Suarez before, she had told me that she believes that addiction is just rampant among the homeless communities. And Dave, Colleen, you both know that that is a hot button issue. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But we now have the data from the King County Medical Examiner's Office that shows us not only is addiction rampant in the deaths of people dying outside, but the deaths are growing. And in 2023, there were more than 420 people who died outside.
That's so
sad. The medical examiner's data shows that 74% of them died from accidental drug overdose.
What does your gut tell you about what We Heart Seattle is doing out there and the fact that the city really isn't trying to stop them, really isn't trying to help them?
Well, you know, that part, that last part might actually be changing. It looks like the relationship between the city and We Heart Seattle is changing, perhaps thanks to several new city council people. But my analysis of the entire thing is that, look, these bones were found on that green space at Dexter Avenue. And they were found by volunteers, not city crews, despite the fact that we now have confirmation from the Washington Department of Transportation that it is city land. We now know from Seattle Parks and Recreation that one of the reasons why crews didn't go in there is because it's a steep slope. And so it might be dangerous for those crews to go in there, in which case they would hire contractors. Now, we don't know if the city did hire contractors or why they didn't. It appears they didn't. But there is seemingly a void of inaction
that
We Heart Seattle is filling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, bringing with them the baggage that comes from the criticisms of people who don't agree with their tactics. But my analysis is that when there is this void, that citizens will often sometimes step in to do what they believe is right.
Yeah.
And be that for better or for worse. You know, my series In Plain Sight tried to examine all of the things around this issue. And, you know, we only have a limited amount of time. I wish I had had more time to put this together. So it's a very complex issue, you know, and you have people on both sides of this who believe that they're doing what is right. And yet they're left with a void of uncertainty. And the people who I talk to who are in the middle of this debate, homeless people, are often looking around and they don't know who to trust. You know, and building trust is something that we've heard from homelessness outreach officials many, many times is very important.
You have to make multiple contact with somebody before they'll trust you or offer those services. Absolutely.
That's correct. And so this lack of trust is really standing in the way, it looks like, of building long-lasting relationships that try and help people get out of this homelessness.
But now, the thing we're not talking about here is the only thing that's going to make a difference at this point is if we adopt some kind of policy that compels some people to get treatment, right? I mean, that's what this is about. We've decided that freedom means if you're slowly killing yourself on drugs, we're going to let you do it.
Well, Dave, I'm not going to give you my policy opinion on the air, but I will tell you that, you know, other people agree with you. Other people don't. And I guess we might be seeing some changes in the way that the city of Seattle interacts with We Heart Seattle. What that means for the overarching way that the city or perhaps county handles this housing first model of homelessness outreach, that remains to be seen.
Did the mayor or council president offer any comment on We Heart Seattle or your series here? Because it sounds like they're going to be the ones with the purse strings and the power to either adopt We Heart Seattle's tactics or go a different direction.
When I reached out earlier this year to the city in the mayor's office, basically all they had told me is that they've had no official coordination in the past. And that they have not paid them for any services.
Well, let's keep on it.
Sam Campbell. Thank you, Sam.
Thank you.
Your daily dose of kindness brought to you by Heritage Homecraft, a nice little story out of Scotland. Kindness can be found in all corners of the globe. On the small island of Sandy, one of the Orkney Islands off Scotland's northern coast. I didn't know these existed. I had to zoom in and really find it. There's a man named Dan who made a big Easter mistake. He owns a grocery store. See, it's a tiny one for the island with a population of just 500 people. He wanted 80 chocolate Easter eggs, but he accidentally ordered 80 cases. That's 720 chocolate eggs for, again, that population of 500. Not great odds to turn a profit, but that's when his heart took over. He decided to make the eggs a charity event, raffling off groups of 100 eggs with proceeds going to the Royal National Lifeboat Institution. It's the largest lifeboat service where he is. And it worked. He raised £3,000, even had to order more chocolate eggs to keep the raffling going. He was invited on a local radio station, which then turned the egg mishap into a worldwide story. And that meant the manufacturer of the chocolate eggs, Nestle, got word of it and offered to match any donations up to £10,000. Dan said it's incredible to see how a simple, embarrassing mistake can turn into an opportunity to make a positive impact.
I don't know, 720 chocolate eggs in a population of 500.
Easy.
We could eat those.
You probably didn't see the eggs. They're the Nestle eggs that also have, well, they call them Smarties over there, but they look like M&Ms.
Yeah.
So it's a chocolate egg filled with basically M&Ms.
Of course.
Delicious.
749.
Is this thing on?
Here he is from the Journey Slow Show, G. Scott. So we heard yesterday about the new Seattle Police contract, and now we're looking at the numbers. So starting salary, nearly $103,000.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to get some new recruits, right? Nothing else has worked.
But I mean, if you was living in South Dakota, we in Seattle, y'all.
You think that's not enough?
I mean, I'm not saying it's not enough. I'm just saying that $102,000 in Seattle isn't exactly like you got a yacht and you private jets all the time.
But how many officers actually live in Seattle? I know it's preferred by some to live outside of the city you serve. It's a good break.
Yeah, I've always believed that is good for law enforcement. I remember growing up and, you know, the neighborhood officer, right? That was always a good thing. I think that law enforcement would be better off sometimes when you live in the same area. So I believe in that. Well, I mean, first of all, I'm for it. I'm always for employees being able to get more money, especially right now, considering everything else is starting to cost. And so the entry level pay for these officers will go from $83,000 to just over $102,000. Currently, right now, if I were to ask you or you were to ask your friends, where do you think right now today that SPD, the Seattle Police Department, where do they rank in the state when it comes to pay?
In the state.
Where would you say? Like, where would you say, and where would you think that they would deserve, maybe? Like,
I would say top five.
Fair, yes. You would think the Seattle Police Department would be top five. Right now, they're 29th.
Ooh.
You know what I mean? Come on now. Now, and this is no disrespect to other law enforcement agencies in the state. Right now, Redmond is number one, right?
Why is that?
They got the money.
Redmond has the money. Ah, yeah. The taxes.
Yeah, tax base.
Taxes, yeah. So, we got a lot of people living there with money.
So, I look, now again,
this is a lot of people in Seattle with money, though.
This is no knock on any other law enforcement, because I know we have those listening, and I don't want y'all to think I'm trying to play favorites, but I do believe, what, Colleen said it, SPD should at least be top five.
It's a major metropolitan city.
You know what I mean? So, right, the fact that they're 29th is something. So
this is before overtime, though. Right.
That's yes.
A lot of overtime.
This is before overtime. Yeah. And we all know what has happened since 2020. 700 officers have left, have made an exit from SPD. It has been an exit from law enforcement all over the country. This isn't just a local thing. But since we're talking about here locally, it's been a lot here. The applications are shrinking right now. And then right now we have the workforce down from 1,300 to 900. So you have that as a concern. So I think one of the biggest things going forward is I think it's going to help with this new Seattle City Council. That's going to help. I kind of give a shout out to them. I think that the last Seattle City Council, I don't know, it just seemed to be a disconnect between what was going on with law enforcement, the mayor, and the council, right? I think we can all agree.
Did you have a feel for what the morale level is?
At the Seattle Police Department?
You know, I like to be fair, because I think sometimes when we come on these topics, we talk to like two or three officers about law enforcement, and then we tell you how the morale is, right? Yeah. With it, I'll say this: I think that the opinion and the discussions and how SPD or law enforcement is talked about hasn't been favorable. Because we sometimes get stories that happen recently when you have law enforcement talking to others on the phone laughing about the tragedy of an accident.
We hear the bad stuff.
We hear the bad stuff.
Yeah.
Whereas in yesteryear, we didn't hear that bad stuff. Mm-hmm. Yesteryear, that stuff was whether it was covered up or whether it was just not talked about.
Well, accountability is good, but it's up to the police department and the chief to release those positive stories. We see that in communities, smaller communities, the small police departments who are on Facebook and social media, they'll say, our officer bought a car seat for somebody today. Our officer did the toy drive today. We need more of those stories.
When you have the positive stories, let's talk about that. But when you have the negative stories, do something about that.
Yes. Yeah.
You know,
accountability.
So there's that answer. Hey, good morning, y'all.
Yeah.
Good morning. Coming in.
Have a good
one. Fired up.
Dave,
Travis Mayfield joining you again
today.
Travis
Mayfield's going to join me. Have you talked to the people upstairs? Because they like you better upstairs than they like me. You should talk to them about you and I going on the road, man.
Oh, really? Are you pitching that? Did you pitch it upstairs?
I'm really pitching that.
Yeah. No,
I'm
too fun. As long as you do the driving.
I'll
drive you too, so you can just kibitz in the back. I want to go to Vegas with you too. Are you kidding me? You can't leave me behind.
I guess that means deadline's almost here, isn't it? Actually, it is over, but 12 days away. So we thought we'd consult with our tax whisperer, Ken Williams from CLA. And one of the questions that people wonder about is, when do the ramped up audits kick in? Now the IRS has all that extra money to hire more agents. When will we see that letter in the mail? So I asked Ken whether he's noticed a difference. Well, first of all, in service levels for taxpayers who have questions.
Yeah, we've seen some improved timeliness in correspondence. Of course, it's coming off the heels of COVID, where it was hard to get a response to anything for a while. But we have seen more responsiveness on the phones and in correspondence. We've also seen an increase in activity of the IRS investigating things, particularly with regard to this employee retention credit that is, you're seeing a lot in the news right now. The IRS just touted that they estimate they've already saved $1 billion in fraudulent claims related to the employee retention credit.
Now, these were the payments that went out during the pandemic to keep businesses open, and some people decided to take advantage of that.
Yeah, exactly. This was a credit that was created during COVID, basically trying to reward employers for continuing to employ their employees, even when they had significant declines in revenue. And so you could file this claim and get a refund or a credit from the IRS for having continued to employ your employees. And unfortunately, a lot of people fell victim to to people that were out there marketing these things and filing claims that just weren't valid. And so the IRS has really ratcheted up their compliance. They provided a chance to come forward voluntarily that ended last week, where you could basically come forward and say, I think I may have been convinced to file a claim that wasn't valid, and you get a free pass on penalties and interest. That expired last week. They estimate about $250 million were refunded through those voluntary disclosure arrangements. Another $250 million was people that just came forward and said, I'm withdrawing my claim. And then another $500 million of the IRS sending out notices saying, we think your claim's fraudulent, and unless you provide documentation, we're not going to give you the credit.
We're hearing from our tax whisperer, Kenneth Williams from CLA. What about the IRS's new direct filing system? That would be a software program run by the IRS itself, so you wouldn't have to buy a program like TurboTax. Here's the update on where that stands.
The direct file was piloted this year in 12 states. This is a software package that the IRS, the Treasury, developed themselves for individuals so that they wouldn't have to pay for tax software to file their return. So it was filed in 12 states, including Washington, this year. So people have begun using it. It's limited. It only does the basics. If you have a lot of unusual things on your return, it's not going to work. And you're going to have to use another software package. But it's baseline. Now, actually, Treasury's always had this free file system where they partnered with a lot of these tax prep software companies to say, look, if a person has a super simple return, we want you to offer to allow these people to do it for free. And you can go to the IRS website and it'll direct you there. And if you meet the qualifications for a simple return, that software company will prepare your return for free. And so it's always done that. But this time they've written the software themselves and promoting it. There's a lot of discussion right now about, is that a good idea? One of the problems with it is it only does your federal return. Now, we don't think about that much here in Washington state, but if you're in a state that has an income tax, it's nice to use the federal software, but if you still have to buy another software package to do your state return, then you know you're not saving that much. And that's one of the main criticisms. So it's become a bit of a political thing as well, with people saying, well, is the IRS really, should it be in the business of writing software and all of this expense? So we'll see. And they're going to be evaluating after this tax season to say, how did the pilot go? How many people used it? It doesn't sound like the wheels came off. It sounds like the software worked as was intended, although, again, it only does certain types of returns. But I'm sure that we'll be seeing more in the headlines about whether or not they're going to continue this and expand it or not.
On the subject of state tax returns, I know you keep up on the state's capital gains tax. Apparently we're going to have an initiative that would once again let us vote against an outright income tax. Where does all that stand now?
The state long-term capital gains excise tax was ruled constitutional by the Washington State Supreme Court, and the federal Supreme Court denied certiorari, so it's the law. There is this initiative 2109 that will be on the November ballot, offering to repeal that tax, the long-term capital gains excise tax. It's a little confusing because there's also initiative 2111, which is a completely separate initiative that is saying that would prohibit state and local governments from imposing an income tax. And one of my concerns is that people will confuse those two initiatives and think that they're voting against the capital gains excise tax when they vote against the income tax. The capital gains tax isn't an income tax, according to the state Supreme Court, but it does muddy the water a little bit. So we'll see. There was an awful lot of money raised in support of this initiative to repeal the excise tax, you know, several million dollars to raise the initiative and only about $21,000 to oppose it, the initiative. So we'll see what happens in the fall with the excise tax. That's kind of the last ditch effort to repeal this tax at this point.
And again, Ken, remind us who the excise tax applies to.
Yeah, so the capital gains excise tax applies to anyone with long-term capital gains, net long-term capital gains in excess of $250,000 during the year. So you pull that number off of your income tax return, but it is a 7% excise tax on those long-term capital gains occurring during the year. And it doesn't include short-term capital gains. And then there's a whole list of things that are excluded from that. For example, real estate. That's the biggest thing that people panic about. Well, I sold my home. Am I going to have to pay this tax on the sale of my home? Well, no. The sale of real estate is not subject to the tax. And there's several other exclusions. But people with gains from sale of stocks and bonds or from sale of a business, if it's not a qualifying small business, are going to be subject to the tax.
Kenneth Williams from CLA. It is 8:22. Colleen, what else are we following this morning?
The Snohomish County Sheriff's Office is warning healthcare workers of a new scam. The scammers say the employee was previously subpoenaed for expert testimony but failed to appear in court, and they're asked to pay a fine through electronic transfer. The Sheriff's Office says no law enforcement will ever call and demand money. Researchers of Vancouver Island say a sandbar stands between an orca calf and its freedom. It's been an around-the-clock effort for more than a week to help rescue the 2.5-year-old. Its mother died getting stranded on that sandbar. And a former Tacoma police officer is back to an...
8:49, and that's Mickey time. Women's college basketball is finally on the front page, and Mickey Gana has talked about how endorsement money has changed everything for athletes like University of Washington guard Jada Noble.
How about Jada Noble? Her first three attempt is money.
UW guard Jada Noble doesn't hesitate when it comes to taking crucial shots on the court. She scored a season high, 11 points in the win against Air Force, and a new career high, 15 rebounds at Arizona State. The Spokane native Noble says she wanted to play hoops since the third grade.
My dad just started coaching me a little bit harder in high school, and then I just realized I could get a scholarship from it, and I always just loved it, you know, so much.
She committed to play for the Huskies in 2020.
I met the girls, and the girls just did it for me. I have a different coach than the coach I originally signed to, but what mattered to me was just the people more than anything. And Seattle's an amazing location. You know this, being here.
When she's not draining threes, Noble is working on her other passion, art. She started painting designs on shoes, t-shirts, and jeans for her friends and sister 2 years ago.
And then she was like, you should make art page. And then I've just gotten just a lot of just love and support, like attention from that. So that's been great.
So much attention, she caught the eye of Seattle Storm guard Jewel Lloyd.
She reached out and she had me design her next shoe. So like I have that coming out before this season. And I wanted to do some more stuff like that.
On top of that, she's an NIL athlete, which stands for name, image, and likeness. It means she can earn endorsement money promoting products like JBL headphones and speakers.
I mean, it's amazing just to see where we've been at and how far we've came with college athletics, especially like the women's side of it is really amazing. And like JBL was my first big one, you know, of course that I got. And I was so excited.
She says people who think college students shouldn't be paid just don't understand.
You know, we really are professionals in retrospect. And it's like, it's a business, you know, our coaches get paid. So in a way, why not us?
And there's prestige with being an endorser.
It helps me definitely think about how I present myself more, you know, off the court more than anything. I mean, when I walk out of this room, like I'm not only representing UW, but I'm representing JBL and any other NIL that I might have.
And as a junior, she's helping the younger players on the team learn this new world.
The freshmen are very, very like eager. They're just like, what do they make you post? Like, how did you do this? Like, did you look over your contract? Like, just really important questions. And I think that's really cool to see them being so thoughtful about it.
Noble hopes to play professional ball and turn her passion for art into a career.
I do eventually want to go overseas. And I think having that balance of art allows me to do that more with overseas than WNBA. So that's why I want to take that route.
Jada and the Huskies struggled a bit on the court this year, but they continued to build support for women's basketball and for financial opportunities for the next generation of players. Mickey Gomez, Cairo News Radio.
And Mickey joins us in the studio. Have we given up on the idea of the, you know, scholar athlete that the NCAA has tried to maintain all these years?
No, not at all, because a lot of the players, not everyone is invited to the NIL. So a lot of times, I mean, even my daughter, you know, we're not banking on that. We're saving for her college. Mm-hmm. And then she tells me that she's going to go to a D1 university on a full ride because of the fact that she's going to have good grades and she's going to be that type of athlete. So we're hopeful.
Yeah. It sounds like, though, for some people, this is almost like a, well, like a farm team, vocational program.
What do you mean by that?
You're there for the sport.
Well,
not
sure.
To be a university student.
Well, why not? If you're good at playing sports. I mean, I think about that all the time, with especially with my daughter, Gigi. You know, she reminds me a lot of this athlete, Jada Noble. Mm-hmm. And so we talk a lot about her future. And I ask her all the time, have you given thought? I know you're young. What do you want to be when you grow up? I want to be a professional basketball player. I mean, that is our life. That until my daughter says no more. That mm-hmm. is her life, and that's what she wants to be. She will go to college, and she, what's so funny is that she thought she could major in professional basketball playing in college. And I said, no, you actually have to major in, you know, communications or law or medicine. She's like, yeah. Really? I can't just go to college and get a bachelor's in basketball?
Though. Why not? You know, why would you waste your time, you know, learning accounting or whatever when you could spend that time becoming a better basketball?
Not everybody makes it to the pros.
Well, not everybody makes it as an accountant either. I mean, you know, I know it's different, but mm-hmm. what I'm saying is maybe we should just drop this distinction and say this is a legitimate career now.
It could be a legitimate career, but not everyone gets drafted. Not everyone gets invited to play for the WNBA or the NBA or whatever sport that they want to play. But it would be nice. I mean, I guess they always say you should have a plan B. I never had a plan B, but because I always wanted to be in communications. Mm-hmm. My dream was to always work with Sully.
Well, look at this. Dream fulfilled.
Yeah, right.
No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, that's hilarious.
We must be in heaven. Thank you, Mickey.
And I just want to thank, you know, all of the companies out there that are recognizing women athletes now and are having them as endorsers. It means a lot as a woman.
Because they can make money now.
They absolutely they can.
That's right. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you will never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.